Okay, well, we're back on air, and we've got Mr. Peter Rickies and Ms. Frankie Hill.
Indeed.
Kia ora.
Kia ora. So, so both of you were at the Rangihaua hearings to decide on how the park... Well, I guess I'm not really sure what the purpose of the hearings are. Maybe someone could explain that.
It quite clearly stated to validate the three leases plus the proposal to set aside an area for an emergency helicopter pad.
Right.
I have the papers here if you
wish. Okay. Lovely. So, so you guys both sat through different parts of the hearings, and I was just curious to know if you had any sort of, you know, observations about, I don't know, yeah, what it was like, or some of the arguments that were made, or yeah.
You go first, Frankie.
All right. Well, I was there for about 3 hours on Wednesday and about 6 hours on Thursday, so I wasn't there for the whole thing. But and I've never attended proceedings like that before, so it was all pretty new, and I was interested in how the process works. But I thought it was really interesting seeing the range of arguments put forward by different people in the community. Interesting to see how particular pieces of misinformation have been clung to and presented as fact by certain people.
So let's maybe just do that first part first. What were some of the interesting arguments or different range of arguments that were put forward that you thought were quite interesting? And
well, I thought it was I thought it was really interesting that the main thrust of the submissions of the that were spoken to by members of the golf course sort of seemed to take the tack that this was about the survival of the golf club. That if this didn't occur, then the golf club would be gone. And they were kind of arguing against the removal of the golf club rather than arguing for an extended lease and ratification of the current leases, I guess, is what you know. Sort of, what's the word for that, Peter? What they want to do to these for these leases that weren't legal in the first place?
Well, I think we need to be clear, as the chairman of the hearing committee said, that the three leases, and for those who aren't familiar, lease to the Waiheke Golf Club, lease to the Waiheke Island Riding Club, and a lease to the Waiheke Island Historical Society of various areas of the Rangihaua Recreation Reserve, are not worth the paper they're written on, quote, unquote. So what we're looking at is a legal process, and it's all set out in the minutes and the council papers I have here, to validate what in effect will be new leases.
So it seemed to me that the main thrust of the arguments coming from those people who were speaking exclusively in support of the golf club lease was that the implication in the argument was that the golf club was in danger of being removed from the area.
And that would explain why there were so many things saying how valuable the golf club was to the is to the community, which I don't think anyone is disputing.
That's right.
I think, you know, it's great that people have a sport like golf that they go and play. I mean, I don't know anyone who's actually said we shouldn't have a golf club on
the
island.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking as I was listening to these people as well. I was thinking this is really interesting because I don't know anybody who's arguing for the removal of the golf club. And yet, many of the people that spoke in support of the golf club lease sort of took the tack as if that is what was being proposed. So, and I think that's kind of a
red herring.
Well, it's a kind of a straw man thing, isn't it? It's putting up this thing that nobody's asking for and knocking it down, and it seemed.
So, what were some of the other arguments?
Well, it appeared to me to be a deliberate strategy to use fear that if you dared to go down the road of a reserve management plan, then everything's up for grabs. And a face store of the local board chair at one point said to, I think it was Claudia Lapp, well, you may not end up with a lease at all. There was this sort of fear that if you opened up that, then you might all end up being thrown off the reserve, which bluntly is arrant nonsense.
Yes.
I mean, when you look at a reserve management plan process, one of the first things that's taken into account is what are the needs? How do you establish needs? Here we have three established needs, in one case running back, God, 30 or 40 years, and the riding runs back way before There was even a reserve there, the bridal trail. So that's misleading, I think even dangerous. And I was deeply disappointed when Faye took that approach. I thought, you're fear-mongering here.
I thought the riding club actually had there's two very nice ladies. I don't remember who they were, but I thought they had a really positive outlook, and they had a really they said something like. We don't mind if the leases continue for a couple of years to give us a chance to think about what we really want for the reserve.
Yes.
And then we have a reserve management plan. And if the decision through that process is made that maybe the riding club needs to move or, there needs to be changes, then we'd be happy to sort of think about that.
Mm. Yeah, that was Sarah and Jill and Lisa who came from the riding club.
Right, okay. And I thought it was quite interesting that they then came under attack around...
I found Faye's question in response to that quite interesting, because basically she reworded what had been said and said, so what you're saying is that you are prepared to sacrifice yourself, which is not what they said at all, but anyway.
There's a corollary to that which came through from the legal counsel for the golf club. And it's part of the thing you're talking about as well. There's no other land for a golf club. Mm. There's nowhere else we can have a golf club. Again, that is arrant nonsense. I mentioned Ngāti Power Station. You could get 20, 36 whole golf courses there if they went through the right process. Right next door is a 30-acre block owned by a chap called Marshall, which is not on the market, but Nigel would sell it for the right price. But, there's your 18-hole golf course. But, no, why is it that we have to use the last large piece of reserve land, recreation reserve land, on the island for a recreation use that 300 people, mainly male, it's only 30 woman members, I don't know how many young members there are. And, that's the debate. The debate is not there should not be golf on the Rangihua Recreation Reserve. The debate is what is the appropriate use for that last precious piece of community resource.
Mm. I think there's also the issue that there's the appears to be very poorly understood issue of public access to the golf club lease area. Anecdotally, I know that there have been incidents of people attempting to trespass people off that land. And there have also been incidents of abuse from people playing golf towards people using the golf course grounds to walk through and ride through. So my understanding from the hearings and from what was said at the hearings is that because it's a public... it's a public piece of land, that being trespassed off the golf club
is a nonsense.
I was actually quite heartened to hear that.
So there's
without
also
a doubt.
I think that's one of the issues as well. That's one of the issues that has kind of stimulated a lot of strong community feeling is the idea that this land is going to be cut off from the rest of the community if the golf club lease is ratified. I can say, if what was said at the hearing is true, that is not correct, that the golf club does not have the legal right to trespass people off the land so long as they are not interfering with golfers going about their golfing business.
We need to be clear about two things. This is our land. Mm. This is the recreation reserve owned by the people and community of Waiheke Island.
Mm.
That's the first thing. So, nobody can be trespassed off common reserve.
Mm.
There is, under a different set of laws, the Resource Management Act, a plan which talks about how that land can be used. And you might have heard, I think it was riding club people, talk about how both golf and horse riding, through the recent plan processes, this is a new plan, not the operative plan, are permitted uses on that reserve. There is, of course, obviously a conflict between those two uses, and the bridle trail definition process was designed to resolve it. I was present through days and days and days of mediations and hearings in the Environment Court. It was resolved, it was signed off, and then the golf club walked away from it. So,
I just think it's such a shame, honestly. When I spoke to people in Wellington, I've got friends who play at the Sheldon golf course. I mean, I don't know anything about golf, but they said... when I told them the story about the shenanigans here, they were just really surprised. They said that they live in a place where it's a private club and yet there are rights of way through it, and people come and pick pine cones. There are dogs that go through. Occasionally a dog grabs a ball and runs off with it. And, I mean, I can understand you can't do that in a tournament, but not every day is a tournament. And if people are just outside enjoying a nice day, then surely we can all be out there enjoying the nice day and just respect each other.
It's common sense.
Yeah, and it seems to work in other places, so it's always surprising it doesn't work here. The other thing that... there was another thing that struck me, which was the thing of people being asked what they felt the use of the land should be. And I felt, well, I kind of felt that was... well, for a start, I hadn't really thought about it. It was more that I felt the wetland should be protected and that the leases should be sorted out. And I also wonder why we have to have an idea for how to use the land.
Well, I don't think
because
we do.
I think, you know, if there's something to be said about a land that's just a free area to roam in rather than being developed for specific purposes. I don't know what any thoughts.
Well, there's a range of issues here. Firstly, as Tony Pope himself said, you know, we need to think about this land 10, 20, 30 years out. And maybe, as one of the hearing commissioners, I think it was Don, said, you know, should it just be land bank? Should we just leave it as open land? And, you know, that's... The problem is quite simply this. The process that's being used preempts the proper process.
Yes.
The proper process is a reserve management plan process, which looks at all these things.
See, and that, for me, makes me think, or kind of reminds me of a thought that I've had over the last few days, which seems to also be implied in a lot of the sort of questions and statements that have been made, which is that those people... who have objected to these existing leases being ratified and renewed somehow have some extended plan in mind of what they want to see happen on the land. That's certainly not the case for me. I submitted to the I put in a submission with my partner, and what our submission said was that we don't think that the current leases should be renewed, that they should be issued on a temporary basis, and that a reserve management plan should be developed. And my thinking about that is, because the process thus far has not been followed correctly and the community hasn't had the input that I think they are entitled to...
on their land.
On their land. That
not the golf club's land.
That opportunity has
not
to
Tony
be...
Not Tony Pope's land.
Yes, but that opportunity has to be afforded to the community. And whatever the community decides at the end of that process, whatever that plan comes up with, is fine with me, you know.
I think there's an important... Sorry, Frank, have you finished that point?
Well, except if they said infill the wetlands. I wouldn't be happy with that. But then, you know...
But they can't do that under a proper reserve management plan process, because the plan protects, you know, areas of high environmental value. One of the joyous things I got out of Janet Hunt's submission is that somebody was actually thinking about the aquifers and the wetlands and the connectivity between the water bodies, not just in that little square of land, but in that whole catchment and the whole valley. And, of course, that's Janet's very good at that. But, you know, that's part of what our thinking should be.
So can I just ask about the feeling, and I can only say it was a feeling, was that a reserve management plan was not the preferred option of the panel. They seem to be steering away from that, saying that it would cost a lot to do, that it wasn't necessary. I just had a feeling that was not the way they were going. Any thoughts on that?
I've got here
some reason why
the legal options associated with activities on Rangihua Park, aka Anitangi Sports Park, Waiheke Local Board, file reference CP2011, vertical/13242, yes, I am a lawyer, 16th of August 2012, where this is a legal report prepared for the board, what are your options, and this is where this hearing process was driven out of, and it talks about granting the lease, the memorandum of understanding, which gives security of tenure in the short term, and... Item F, the Waiheke local board make a decision on preparing a reserve management plan once the process and outcome of the leases on the site is finalised.
That's a nonsense.
You see, the
that's
problem
the wrong way
for me.
That's preemption.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So,
so we need to sheet home very clearly where this is coming from. It's coming from our local board and it's coming from the council. Now, what the reasons are, I could give you views on that. But certainly everybody has a broad view that the reserve management planning process is time-consuming, it needs to be time-consuming, and that it's expensive. Well, we went through one for years, way back in 1995, and then after all that time and all that expense, they threw it in the cupboard and
didn't do anything with
shut
it, yes.
the key. Mm. Locked the key away.
Yeah, I don't understand why it needs to be so expensive. I guess there's consultants out there that charge exorbitant fees. I won't mention any names. But planning consultants of various different stripes who charge a lot of money.
I just don't understand why this has been going. Like it's been flagged since 2003 that this area needs a reserve management plan. So I don't understand why in all that time money hasn't been found to do one. Well, and why are we in a hearings process, which is, you know, it just seems like more money down the toilet that could have gone towards actually just getting a plan sorted out.
It preempts a real reserve management plan.
The only thing that makes sense to me is that there's certain people in certain key areas who have a vested interest in not seeing a reserve management plan developed. What that vested interest is, I don't know. But I would say that that's certainly my strong feeling, is that there are people who are influential, shall we say, who have control over whether that happens or not, or at least have the ability to stall it and delay it and put it off and suggest other options and maybe sneak one of those options through, because for some reason the reserves management plan does not serve their interests.
I mean, I think it's always difficult dealing with things that, that you can't see, and so a lot of that is, you know, hearsay until we've actually got evidence to prove otherwise. It does. I mean, I think what I think a lot of people don't seem to realise is that if the current leases are accepted in the way that they are and there is no reserve management plan, then all of that free land will be taken up by a golf course. And I don't know that people actually understand that, because when I've said that to people, they don't actually understand that that whole of that area will become a golf course. And then next to that, there will be a couple of playing fields. So for me, the real thing is that thing of occupying 9 holes, which is fabulous, great community asset. Potentially it's something that the golf course can actually manage, the golf club can actually manage. Moving to 18 holes, where they will need a constant drip feed of council money to maintain an 18-hole golf course, where they'll be draining vast amounts of water to maintain 18 holes, especially through the summer, and where they've clogged up or used up all the available land so that it can't be land banked. It's just, I mean, you can't have a golf course that's there for 2 years and then take it away.
There's a subsidiary issue. If, and I think he's quite correct, the chairman of the hearings panel is correct in saying the leases aren't worth the paper they're written on.
Mm. Oh, did he say that?
Yes. Where does that leave the resource consents granted to the golf club based on them having a valid legal right to occupy that area?
Right.
Yeah.
Which, of course, people are complaining about, and probably quite rightly so. That's not an area that I've seen sufficient information on, but, you know, wetlands are a precious part of what we are, and so is the coastal fringe. And we shouldn't fiddle with either of those without, you know, very clear environmental impact assessments.
Well, as was pointed out, you know, the health of our oceans starts in the watercourses in the land. And if you start to degrade, and unfortunately the wetlands there have already been degraded to some great extent, which is not to say they cannot recover.
Be rehabilitated.
They can recover, and they will recover if left to their own devices and not mown and not infilled and et cetera, et cetera. I have to say, with the 18-hole golf course idea, personally I'm not opposed to an 18-hole golf course, so long as they can maintain the watercourses and the wetlands in the way that they should be maintained. I don't know whether the two are incompatible or not. I don't know enough about it. Certainly.
Yeah, it's interesting that a lot of people say that. You see, I think I feel that 9 holes is enough, and that there might be other users who'd like to use that space for other purposes, or that it's just quite nice to walk around the wetland with, you know, as a grassy, unmanaged area. So that's quite an interesting, yeah.
I don't know enough about it to really comment on whether it's possible to have both. But
it's possible for the golf club, if it had the funds, which is a separate issue, to buy adjoining land and have their own 18-hole golf course without using the last large piece of public recreation land on the island. Now, the only valid test is the Reserve Management Act process, Reserve Management Plan process, which looks at the different recreational needs now and into the future. And if, after going through that process, they say, yes, an 18-hole golf course is the paramount need, then we've been through a transparent, rigorous, authoritative process which involves the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anything else is a nonsense. This hearing process, I'm going on record, is a nonsense because it preempts. By the time you get round to doing a reserve management plan, you've got nothing left to plan.
Yes. Mm. Yes, that's the thing.
So that's a bit worrying, isn't
it? It's an Alice in Wonderland type
of
exercise.
Well, if the outcome is to ratify the leases and grant extended leases to the golf club in particular, the figures I've seen, I don't know whether that's what's being proposed now, but the figures I've seen is a 10-year lease with a 10-year... two 10-year rights of renewal or something, so effectively a 30-year lease.
Okay, well, let's have a little track and then we'll get back into some other bits and pieces. I guess, I mean, we're pretty much done, but one of the things for me as well is why did this need to go to a hearings process, and why was money spent on a hearings process when we've been asking for a reserve management plan, and couldn't some of that money have been allocated to reserve management plan? Any thoughts on that?
Well, that hearing process is expensive, believe you me. I wouldn't like to throw a quick figure on it, but it would be certainly in the thousands, maybe even the tens of thousands, which is a decent, you know, way of starting off the reserve management plan process. The short answer to your question is that our local board deemed it, in their view, and I don't know what consultation they undertook, that this was the appropriate process to resolve use of the Rangihua recreation reserve areas. They made that decision on our behalf. I personally have to go on record as saying I totally disagree with that decision. I believe the process is too limited. Yet again, there's been no evidence of any sort of consultation with iwi, let alone the wider Māori community. I've ensured that's been placed on the record through Ngāti Poa. You won't know about that, Frankie, but I took care of that. So that's now been taken care of. And where are we at again? We're at a half-assed process, which is the wrong process, which at the end of the day is already deeply divisive as far as this community is concerned, which is going to end up in litigation. Now, is that in the interests of the good people of Waiheke?
Well, I don't think it is, and I could hazard a guess as to the motivation. It's a good old-fashioned term called ass-covering. I think certain individuals want to have their actions whitewashed, and they don't want to face community scrutiny.
I think it's a shame that it's becoming different groups against each other and different interests, because essentially everyone enjoys the outdoors. All the people who are arguing are people who enjoy the outdoors and therefore see some value in the space.
Yes, well,
and it would be really nice to just see everyone just you know, coming to the table and talking about how they can work together to use the space, you know, use the bridle tracks, use the golf course, use it for just walking through, protect the wetlands. And I do think it's really, really achievable.
I think it's achievable too. But
I wish the local board would show some leadership in making that happen, because I think that would be like a really positive thing that they could do. And to their credit, I have to say, you know, I think they've... You know, the local board have been quite impressed at what they've been doing in Sandy Bay. they seem to have managed to sort of take on board feedback from different groups around how that area of Sandy Bay should be used, and to close it for a certain amount of hours in the day to keep people safe, but also allow boats through there. Mm. And it just seems to be a good compromise solution, and it'd be really nice to see them making more decisions like that.
Well, I think the board has contributed to the divisive nature of this conversation that we've been having around Rangihaua, and that's really all I've got to say on that.
Mm. Well, I want to go one step further, because it's not just Rangihaua. If you look throughout the tenure of the board, I mean, there's a very long list. There's the Esplanade Road issue, which has been covered in the paper. There's the Onitangi Strait issue. There's tourism and events planning. There's transport planning, which I've just done 2 years' work on. The transport planning in Maotea Terminal is in a state of total chaos. It is absolutely scary. It's worse than the Wild West. I've addressed the board on this issue. I've given them the benefit of a very extensive research study. Disabled car parks go leaping hither, thither and non, as do parks for motorbikes, and the whole thing is just so Mickey Mouse, we could open it and call it Disney World. There's a nice line.
Okay, so moving on from that, Maitea-tea.
Maitea-tea,
and are there still... What's been happening with this marina? Because that's all gone quite quiet. Do you know anything about that?
It's about to be re-notified, probably before Christmas. I'm not the person to speak to on that, because I'm not representing the developers or the iwi from this point on. But I just wanted to finish, I think, which is a critical point, and I wanted to ask the question whether we've reached a point that the leadership of the local board, particularly the chair and deputy chair, have lost the confidence and support of the community they are charged with serving. I'll give my own personal answer to that, but I think that it's time that question was put out there and people started asking it more widely. And if the answers that come back are yes, then in my view, the chairman, Faye Storer, and the deputy chair, Joe Holmes, ought to resign. But it's time we had the debate. There are so many different issues that have been divisive. There are so many things that have not been handled well, according to a lot of people. Mm. I'm blown away that, Frankie, you found something that did well. Hallelujah. But, you know, the general culture...
It wasn't me.
the general culture is one of autocratic, non-democratic decision-making. Mm. And I put the question, have we reached the point where the leadership of the board has lost the confidence and mandate of this community?
I think that's a very, very important question that needs to be asked and discussed in the community.
Now, my personal view, yep. I said I'd stick my neck on the line. My personal view is that they have.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll just pretend I'm actually not sitting in Waiheke Radio. And I didn't hear any of that. And your views are not representative of Waiheke Radio Station. We are absolutely unconnected to either of you.
Emphasise the word
like
personal.
Emphasise.
We love you, Tisharan.
Okay, anyway, always fun on Waiheke Radio. I mean, again, it's like, oh, you know, why can't we just get on? I just really wish that we could, you know, that elected representatives acted in the best interests of the community and just bore that in mind.
Well, if they acted like elected
whether
representatives...
Whether they are or not, I'm not going to comment.
If they acted like elected representatives rather than feudal overlords, then, yeah.
I just want to add a little piece to validate my own personal view. I've served for a considerable period of years as a community board chairman. I've served 6 years as a chairman of Auckland Council Committee. I've served on local and national bodies in chairing capacities. This is just not a quick off-the-cuff view. This is an informed, at least semi-expert view about what the proper role of chairman and deputy chairman on a local board is, and how they represent the community and how they advocate for the community. And so, you know, I ask it again, have we reached a point where the leadership of our local board have lost the confidence and mandate of the community? And I'd be very interested in hearing other people's answers to that.
Mm. Oh, well, that can be someone else who gets on radio and maybe tries to address that one and get some people on talking about that. Because I think, you know, if you're an elected representative, you probably open yourself up to having some sort of scrutiny in that way. So, yes. Were there particular reasons that you felt that way, or
I could take another hour listing various issues and cases, Faritana Bay, the handling of the Oniro Bowling Club issue, and so on and so on. I mean, this is not...
I mean, there is a thing in which it's, you know, there is an element in which people can say, oh, well, isn't it kind of sour grapes? It's like, well, you know, certain people got in, they were elected, you know, they have ideological positions which are probably different from mine, but, you know, they were elected, and so consequently... Let's just get on with it.
One of their first acts was to sideline the highest polling candidate. What does that tell you?
But I think the question you're also asking is, what is the proper role of these people and representing? And that's what the act says. They're there to represent and advocate for the community. How do they do that? Do they do that by making autocratic decisions without any consultation? Or, you know, are they bound to show that they've consulted and been through a process of reasoned consideration of the differing points of view?
Mm.
Now, you know, you test it yourself against various issues that have, you know, have been around for the last 18 months, 2 years.
Mm. I mean, I have to say, at a whole Auckland Council level, trying to present at different meetings at Auckland Council, I'm amazed at how much discretion the chair has to decide certain things, which I think aren't really for the discretion of the chair. For example, whether you can even speak at a meeting.
I have concerns about accountability and transparency of process our local board uses. I formed an interim view that it's dangerously close to being illegal. I haven't quite decided whether it's completely illegal. But again, it's, you know, how do you represent, advocate for, and be accountable to your community?
Mm. Mm. The other thing that I have slight issues with is if a lot of stuff is decided in closed workshops, I was told that the outcome of those workshops needs to be transparent. So there needs to be some sort of record of what was discussed, or at least the outcomes. And it can be really difficult to find out, you know, both at the local board but also at council level, what's actually going on. And I think, you know, there are bigger issues around, you know, local boards and Auckland Council and how we're represented at the local level and how we participate in our democratic processes.
I think the standard response from the local boards like to be, well, we haven't got any power at all.
Mm.
But the reality is, when you look at how other local boards work, they're not there to make the Auckland Council officers and management comfortable. In fact, you know, I'd say part of your brief, if this is what your community tells you to do, is to make them as uncomfortable as possible. Be advocating for particular outcomes that are in the interest of your community that may not be perceived to be in the interest of the wider Auckland Council communities of interest. I'm deeply concerned about a whole trend towards homogenisation of Waiheke Island.
Mm.
You know, removing the houseboats, yes. You know, various other issues. The failure to take account again and again and again. Faritana Bay is only one example. Matiatia, what's happening down there, is another.
So can you give us
critical heritage values?
Yeah.
These are the things that make us different. Otherwise, we're going to end up as another Pawanui or Gulf Harbour, heaven forbid. And I'd be off to the barrier along with, you know, many others probably.
Mm. Yeah. Can we just talk very quickly about Matiatia?
Yeah.
So what... what's going on? Because I understand they've redone the plans. They've got a lot of support from more groups potentially, and I was just concerned that the process wouldn't be notified. But you think it will be notified?
No, I think really where your fear is coming from, and it's justified, is it will be notified, and then it will be directed straight to a hearing in the Environment Court under the new provisions of the RMA. So there'll be no community level hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to go along, then you're into the Environment Court and all the costs. And
oh, so there wouldn't be a local hearing on it. And what about the submission process? How would that work?
Well, then you'd be submitting to the Environment Court.
Oh, so we're actually not submitting at a local level on,
well,
on the fact
look,
that we
let's
don't.
Be clear about this. As I said, I'm not directly involved.
But you understand the process.
But I've been told that they will be looking to have it directed straight to the Environment Court rather... This hearing we've had on Rangihua, normally you'd go through a lower hearing before the matter is then appealed onto the Environment Court. But again, changes that the national government's made to the RMA allows projects to be zapped straight into.
Right.
And there's no way of appealing that, or
it can be contested, but you know what people rely on often is the fact that communities don't have the time, the resources, and particularly the money to go through that.
And if you appeal at the Environment Court, that presumably would be something that happens in Auckland. Is there a huge cost associated with that?
Well, it's a huge time cost. I mean,
well, all of this is a huge time cost. Mm. Yeah. Okay, because I'm very concerned about having. I have to say, every time I come through Matiatia now, I just look at those little boats bobbing on the bay, and I'm really concerned about putting a marina at Matiatia.
Well,
from the lack of space.
Let me add to your fear and loathing, because as you know, back in June, we had a local board sponsored Matiatia quote conversation unquote, which was supposed to be about the transport issues, but ended up, and I have the, oh dear, the confidential, naughty Peter, how did you get your hands on them? I have the confidential briefing papers which show that this is all about Auckland Council Properties Limited wanting to develop their land holdings down at Matiatia.
Right.
And the papers I have say, in effect, isn't it wonderful that the marina is going to go ahead, because isn't that going to make our job so much easier? We can do this, this and this, and we can join our car parks together, and we can do this, that and the other thing.
Mm.
And, you know, I had the great pleasure of being at Paul Monan's book launch about Matiatia, and that should be compulsory reading for anybody who has anything to do with Matiatia. And Mike Lee said a wonderful thing, and I'm trying to think who he quoted, Milan Kundera, was it, that identity is the difference between memory and forgetting.
Mm.
And heritage is a very, very important part of the identity of this island.
Mm.
And if they turn that valley into some bloody crass multi-storey car park, is one of the things being promoted on the waterfront, and modern commercial development, then
can be just like surfers.
I mean, it's everything we don't want for this island, sadly.
Well, it's interesting because we spent so much time debating the gateway idea and what that meant. And again, I think it was something like 80% of people said they actually just wanted it the way it was, and they felt that that offered a really nice gateway to the environment, and especially with Te Ata Whai Whenua, the hillside that's all been reforested, just that it created a nice, peaceful entryway into the island. And admittedly, you know, once you get into the island and on Iroa and Ostend, and you know, you do sort of you know, find yourself living in a, you know, rural urban environment, but the initial entry point was an entry point of peace and tranquility. The other thing that I'm interested in is apparently in order to put in a marina, you would need to take out 50 moorings. And there are about 100 boats there, and then you'd need to put in, and then the mooring is for about 160 boats anyway. So you could actually just put in 50 more moorings, and then that would solve the whole issue of possible shortage of moorings and be very low impact.
Wonderful idea. The other thing the marina development contemplates is quite major reclamation. I don't know if people realise.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
Yeah, it's a big part of the bay is reclaimed. After all, a 60-car car park has to go in there. Right. So that's beyond the terminal. That's not this side of the terminal.
So is that the area after the second wharf?
Yeah, do you know where the dinghy lockers are?
Yes.
Roughly. Say you're standing beside the dinghy lockers and there's quite a big rock outcrop.
Yeah.
Presently on the foreshore. That gets pushed right out in a reclamation.
Right, so they'll concrete it all and put a seawall.
Yeah, they'll be big.
Yeah. You see, that's the other shame, because it's such a beautiful, beautiful area. Mm. Anyway, Trevor, have you got a show coming on now?
Yeah,
sure. Ah, okay, fine. So I need to get off here so that Trevor can get his show on. Thank you very much for coming in.
Talked enough.
Have a lovely weekend.
Yeah, no, that was great, Trin. Thanks.
Great,
cool.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Me.
Great.
Us, yeah. No, I'll go with that. Cool.
Right.
But I've done it now. Now I'm going to put it in the paper. We've got to have the debate. Everybody's.
I think you're right. Everybody's.